Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. Next interview is with James Day. He's a filmmaker, a documentarian. Fascinating conversation about really, I suppose, about truth being sort of stranger than fiction. And he's, I would call him a filmmaker and a journalist, an investigative journalist, I suppose, but somebody who he says, has been interested in crime, criminals, and psychopaths for quite some time. So you're going to want to listen in on this interview. It's about Charles Manson and his new film, that is called Charles Manson, The Final Words. It all comes out of a conversation that he had with Charles Manson, who put a collect call through to him while James, the director of the film, was sitting at an Applebee's somewhere in the States. We talk about truth and power and justice and empathy. We talk about mental health issues and upbringing. We talk about the crime itself and about alternate theories as well around what actually happened in this particular case. We get into voyeurism and we talk a lot about how the facts don't always match the narrative that comes through to us in story and in history and why that might be a concern for all of us. So coming right up, James Day about his film, Charles Manson, The Final Words. And don't forget, facetofacelive.ca for more information about my own podcasting. And of course, patreon.com if you want to support the work that I'm doing through Face to Face Live. Please go there and check that out as well. Coming right up, James Day about his new film, Charles Manson, The Final Words.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by another very special guest today. James Day is here with us today to talk about his most recent film, Charles Manson, The Final Words. James, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Yeah, I'm so glad. I can't wait to get into this. So not really a cheery pick-me-up, you know? Charles Manson, The Final Words. You've got this crazy phone call that I want to talk about in a minute or two. But I have to say, for me, when I finally finished watching the film, I mean, I can't believe the impact that not only your film had on me, but the memories it brought back to me. I was too young to remember, of course, the murders and so on, but the Helter Skelter, the book, the movie, there was this creep factor throughout. And maybe that's not what it is necessarily, creepiness. It's I don't know, maybe it's the evil of it, or it's the style of photography or something, but there's just something about those images, you know? And
yeah,
listening
absolutely.
To those taped conversations and so on. So bring us into this. Tell us a little bit about the film and about that crazy collect phone call that you got at Applebee's.
A lot of things happen to me at Applebee's.
Applebee's. It's where it all begins, really, isn't it? Oh, and by the way, congratulations on a fascinating, fascinating film.
Oh, thank you very much. I mean, just before we begin, just what you were saying is, you know, I think what fascinates everyone, and what certainly caught on to me at about Charles Manson was that, you know, it's this group of people, and they have these funny names, and they are very strange and weird, and then they commit all these random bizarre murders, and it's just such a fascinating story, regardless of how you come into it.
But, oh yeah, for sure. It's just got documentary film written all over it.
But how I got into it was I was filming a series that I do for the Reels channel called The Shocking Truth, which is on Reels right now, and we were filming the first season. We're just finishing up the second season right now. And during the first season, I've met a couple authors who were working on a manuscript, and one of the authors had actually spoken to Charles Manson, and they kind of, the manuscript they were working on was about this Charles Manson's perspective. Hmm. of the murders, and they said we don't buy into the whole helter skelter thing, and that kind of put the seed of the idea in my mind, and I remember asking them. I said, do you think I could talk to Charles Manson directly? And they said, no way. That'll never happen. You know, one of the authors had spoken to him a number of years ago, but they said no, though, you know, we've been writing him for years now, and he never applies, and all this.
Hmm.
And so, but they said, you know, go ahead. And so I wrote him a few letters, and months later, like I said, I was at an Applebee's. We were filming and just had finished. We were in the middle of Florida in a little town called Crystal River.
And an eight slice pizza, right?
The pizza was the sample platter.
Okay, I thought I read somewhere you were eating pizza when the call came.
No, it was actually, we were, the Crystal River is in the middle of Florida, and it's a very small town. And we had said to the hotel, we checked in the hotel, and I remember we said to the person that was checking us in, we said, is there anywhere good to eat? And they said, oh, there's some great places around here. There's a great local place. Eat there all the time. And we said, great, what's it called? And they said, it's called Applebee's.
Funny.
We said, oh, you know. And I remember she said, have you ever been there? And I said, yeah, I've been to Applebee's.
well-versed in Applebee's, yeah.
Yeah, she said, oh, she's very surprised. So
there you are, yep, eating the sample platter. The call comes in.
Yeah, and then my phone just rang, and it had a funny number on it, and I looked at it, and I picked it up, and it said, and then the voice comes over the line and said, you know, this is the Global Telling, the company that inmates in California use to call out. And it said, this is Global Telling. You have a prepaid call from, and then his voice came on, Charles Manson. And I was shocked. And I was with the director of photography, Nate Harper, who I work with. And I said, Nate, I think Charles Manson's calling me. And he said, what? And I ran out. We both ran outside. I'm sure the waitress thought we ditched on our bill.
Yeah, I bet.
And because it was very loud, so Monday Night Football was on, we ran out to the parking lot. And his voice just came on, and he said, do you accept the call? I said, yes. And he said, hey. And I said, Charlie. And he said, hey, man, I got your letters. And I said, how's it going? And he said, groovy, man. And that was it. And then we started talking. And that started the year of talking to him on the phone.
How bizarre. Utterly bizarre. And he just died on the 19th of November, right?
He did, yeah. Yeah, he did. He died on the 19th of November. And I remember on the morning my phone just blew up. And looked at it, and it was full of text messages. And we were just finishing the documentary. I mean, we were literally finishing it that week.
Right.
All of a sudden, and then that spurred weeks of just work and just getting, we're trying to get it out the door as quick as we could. So is
the lesson to be learned here in our interview today that you should always take collect phone calls? Is that what we're going to come away with?
Yeah, for sure.
I think.
Absolutely.
I think that might be it. I don't even know where to begin. I mean, there's so many things to ask you. Maybe I'm going to start with you a little bit. So why, why crime? It seems like you've got a little bit of an interest there. Based on, you know, your directorial profile, your filmography, and so on. What is it about? Is it criminals? Is it evil? Is it your love for solving a problem?
I don't know. I was always interested in true crime. All crime is true, but I was always interested in crime and criminals and psychopaths from a very early age. My mother is a best-selling author. She's a famous author in Canada. She writes mostly hockey autobiographies. She's wrote Kelly Rudy's book, and she wrote like Wayne Gretzky's book named Kirstie McClellan Day. So she always, our house was always full of books, and she was always really into crime, and so was my grandfather, was always really into kind of true crime books. So, like, I remember reading Helter Skelter in high school and books like that on the bus to high school, and I was always really interested in that. And then in university, I worked in healthcare and did a lot of work in mental health and was really interested in that.
Interesting, yep.
And then I did a postgraduate degree in clinical psychology, and as part of that, I did a lot of writing about psychopaths and stuff like that, and was always very interested in it. And I remember doing a thesis paper on violent psychopaths, and this is before the internet. And I wanted some background research, so I cold called the Milwaukee Police Department and asked for the files on Jeffrey Dahmer.
Oh man!
And they said why, and I said, well, I'm just a graduate student. And I mean, again, this is before the internet, so you could get away with things like that.
Sure, sure. And did you get them?
Yeah, and then they sent me. They said you have to send us $10, and I did. And I got a huge, which I still have. They sent me a huge binder of his verbatim confession and all the files on him and stuff. And so I was always really interested in stuff like that. And then I had worked in a number of genres in television, and true crime is just one I've kind of been successful at.
Yeah, it's I love that as an opening line. You know, I've always been interested in crime, criminals, and psychopaths. That's just, how to win friends and influence people, James. I love it. It's put that on your business card. So, do you believe Manson was he the most famous being human that ever lived? And was that really what he was after? I mean, he says at one point in the film, I think in your conversations with him, that he was trying to get away from civilization.
So to your first question, was he the most? I mean, he was incredibly famous.
Yeah.
Why he was incredibly famous is a long conversation. But
yeah, sure.
Yeah, absolutely was incredibly famous. And he was very much aware of it. And one thing I was really surprised at in speaking with him was how conscious he was of his own notoriety.
and quite proud of it, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. He really understood. I mean, there was good and bad. I know in prison, people tried to kill him a lot. One person tried to light him on fire once and did light him on fire briefly, but he survived. I don't think he was very injured by it. He'd been assaulted. Prison gang had jumped him and tried to kill him once. I think in prison, as it was explained to me, is in prison, if you were the man who killed Charles Manson, that would have been very good for your prison career.
Of course, yeah.
He was kept in a special place that was built actually specifically for him in Corcoran State Prison in California, California State Prison. And it was called the Protective Housing Unit. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, his infamy was good and bad. Also, his infamy helped him survive because if people are afraid of you, they'll kind of leave you alone in prison,
right,
too. That's the other
right.
side of the coin.
Sure, sure.
So, yeah, that was definitely part of it. And sorry, I don't remember what your second question is.
Yeah, I think it was related to this notion of he was trying to get away from civilization.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's something that's very misunderstood about the Manson family. And this is a really consistent thing. I mean, I spoke to many members of the family that are in the documentary. We also tracked down a number of members of the original Manson family. You know, they don't like to be called that.
Yeah, no, of course.
Manson family. But we tracked many members down. And talk to them off camera. They didn't want to participate in the documentary for one reason or another. But that was a really consistent thing they said, was that the idea of what they were doing is that he was trying to create this kind of like prisoner's paradise. You know, he had just gotten out of prison and he was trying to, you know, live in the woods and have women and sex and drugs and do his own thing. I mean, he really didn't want to be part of civilization or society. That's one of the things that's often reported about him is that he wanted to be a famous musician like the Beatles and the Beach Boys.
Right.
But there isn't a lot of evidence for that. In fact, when you look at the reason he wasn't a famous musician is he wouldn't sign contracts. He liked playing his own music. He liked doing his own thing. You know, he was happy kind of being a vagrant, nomadic type person.
At one point, I think in your conversation with him, I think he says something to the effect of it took him years before he knew what the word cult even meant.
Oh yeah, I mean that's a common thing too. I remember Barbara Hoyt recently passed away, unfortunately, but I was the last person to interview her, and I remember her telling me that the word cult didn't come up till very much later. There, even at trial, they aren't described as a cult. And you know, communes of that nature were very common in California.
Sure.
At that time.
Yeah, at that time.
So, yeah, and I mean, there were cults around there at that time, but I mean, the word cult is a very loaded term, and they definitely weren't describing themselves as a cult, and it wasn't kind of till years later that people started retroactively describing the Manson family as a cult.
How much of it, and I think this comes out, you know, without giving too much about the film and so on and what you've uncovered, how much of the story and came out of the, and I don't remember reading it, but I did read it as well.
Sure.
As a young kid, and I think I told you offline that I remember, you know, as soon as I started watching the film, I got goosebumps. You know, I saw the film Helter Skelter, which was based on the book. I think it was made in the mid 70s. I was living in Montreal, I believe, at the time, on this really crummy black and white TV that my family owned. But those images just kept, that came in of the Tate and the Bianca murders and the body lines, I guess you could say, and just all of it. You know, there's mm-hmm. something about those images that they just, I don't know, they almost feel evil. And how much of that comes out of what seems to have been not the true story, which was, in fact, I guess, Helter Skelter, right? Bugliosi's book, Vincent Bugliosi's book.
Bugliosi.
Bugliosi, thanks.
Yeah, the G is actually silent.
Oh, nice.
But it's
how awesome. Non-Canadian.
Yeah, I know, but it's very, everyone calls him Buglio. I think a lot of it's not true. That's the ironic part is, you know, if you go back and you read the initial police reports from the Sharon Tate homicides and the secondary police reports and the original forensics, a lot of it really does not match the narrative that's still being told to this day.
Right.
And we didn't even really get in the documentary into the really specifics of what happened that night on August 8th, 1969. And it's really even, I mean, you could spend a whole documentary talking about what happened that night specifically, because it's been so twisted and distorted and you know, at the trial and over the years. So, you know, definitely the crime scene photos and how the bodies were placed in those murders is horrific and disturbing and shocking when you see them. But what actually happened those nights is a whole thing you could get into. And
is that what Fleischman sort of talks about a little bit when I think the quote from him was something along the line, mm-hmm. the whole thing was scary, but you don't give us any more than that. You just sort of,
yeah, I mean, he's still bound by attorney.
That's what it was. Yeah, that's right. He said he can't actually tell us what actually happened. Or
yeah, he can't actually say exactly what Linda said to him, which is a whole interesting thing. But even, you know, Linda's alleged involvement, what that was, I mean, that's a whole conversation into itself. But I think that's what's really fascinating about the whole Manson story is that you know, you think you know everything there is to know about it, but when you really start to read about it, when you really start to look at it, you realize there's a whole world of stuff we've still that has been ignored or misrepresented or untold.
How much of this? I mean, I just had this thought: was this the beginning of reality TV in some senses? You know that you know, you know what I mean? Like this voyeuristic kind of, wow, am I ever glad I'm not like those crazy animals who shaved their heads and killed those innocent people, you know?
I think it was the end of the 60s. I mean, it was literally the end of the 60s. It was 1969 and the trial took place in 1970. But it was also, it was the end of that. The trial of Charles Manson was, at the time, was the biggest story in America.
Right.
And it really put a period on the end of the sentence of this about the 60s. You know, it was it coincided with kind of the end of the Vietnam War, more or less, and a shift in music and a shift in culture, and it also just terrified Los Angeles and just changed the culture of Los Angeles. Because before that, I mean, we interviewed Jake Sebring's girlfriend, who appears in the documentary. And I interviewed her extensively, and I remember her telling me about, you know, before the murders, you know, there was parties and drugs, and it was a very small community. Hollywood was a very small community. And then when the murders happened, people just went crazy with fear.
Right.
And it kind of just changed Los Angeles, and all this, and that whole kind of old Hollywood scene just disappeared overnight.
The fascinating thing, well, there's so many fascinating things.
Yeah.
Was he 40 miles away when the murders actually took place? And I mean, I think it's fascinating your comment about earlier. You said something like that, you know, the facts don't match the narrative of what's still being told today. I mean, so I guess mm-hmm. the question, I mean, there's so many questions there, I think, James, but one for me is what drew you to this? Clearly the psychopath drew you in, but, you know, is this about justice? You know, is this about a cult of power? You know, was this more about telling, you know, the true story here? And
yeah, I mean, what drew me in for sure was the idea that you could take someone who's so well known, so Charles Manson,
yeah,
who is literally the shorthand for evil.
Yes, indeed.
And you could have that, and there, you could have an entire story about him that's never been told, or the idea that that person that we all know could be misunderstood. That idea is what kind of drove us, in the beginning.
It's interesting. You know, I hadn't thought of this until right this second, but in this age of fake news, pretty interesting insights on a story that's, what, 60, how many years old is this now? 70, 39, 42?
It took place in 1960. The murders were in 1969 and the trials in 1970. So it's been 48 years this year since the trial. So 49 years since the murder. But yeah, that occurred. That's something that's very interesting about Charles Manson is, and we did a ton of research on Charles Manson in making the documentary, and every single article, almost without exception, that I read, and every single documentary, almost without exception, that I saw, is full of factual inaccuracies, wrong names.
That's deeply troubling.
Wrong dates. Stuff left out, stuff taken out of the wrong context, you know, and that is, I found really fascinating about it. I remember we downloaded or we used some images from a very highly reputable image licensor, and they didn't even have names on them.
Wow.
And we were able to go back and say, oh, that is actually not Sandra Good, that's Cappy. This picture, you know, it's not like the picture would be labeled as Nancy Pittman, and we'd say, no, that's not Nancy Pittman. That's, you know, Susan Atkins.
Yeah.
Actually, I remember when Charles Manson died, there was a meme going around the internet on Twitter, I think, and it said, we should not think of Charles Manson or something to that effect, we should be thinking about his victims.
Right.
And had a picture of all the victims. You remember seeing that?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, one of the pictures, the picture that was of the victim, Gary Hinman, was not Gary Hinman. It was the mugshot of Bobby Beausoleil, who was the murderer of Charles Manson.
Okay, it's not funny, but it's hysterical, right?
Yeah, but it's stuff like that. Like, yep. That's how misunderstood this crime is, that everybody thinks they know.
I can't help but think, too, you know, this... we love to, it seems to me, when it comes to things like mental health issues and crimes, and certainly, one of my fascinations, as my listeners know and love, I do a lot of work overseas, a development guy, and I work in Cambodia, and so I've been traveling there for many, many years, and so one of the things that drew me in, similar to maybe your interest in true crime, was Vietnam War and the Khmer Rouge, and just, and so here I was sitting in a Japanese bookstore in 99, reading, I couldn't stop reading history and what Robert McNamara and the bombing and what about Laos and what were they doing in Cambodia and so on and so on, and just got drawn into this on a historical level. And then as I started to fall in love with the country and visited it, you start to ask these questions of how is this possible? The Khmer Rouge, 30% of the country, the parents killing children carrying parents. How? And we like to, I think, it seems to me, oversimplify these things. And so, I mean, is he the personification of evil? I mean, is he truly a psychopath? I mean, at one point in the film, and you rightly bring out this idea of his compassion and empathy were beaten out of him.
Yeah,
what are your thoughts on some of that whole notion? Like, because we love to say Charles Manson, evil, the guy was nuts, he was a madman, don't you know?
Yeah, I mean, he was obviously, he was a product of the prison system that he was raised in. I mean, that's the best way to understand Charles Manson is prison. Everything about him is prison. Like, he spent, I think it was 22 years, he spent 20 years of the first 34 years of his life
in
prison.
That was a crazy.
I think he'd been arrested more than 30 times. He'd been arrested it was like he went around the country trying to figure out what laws he could break and break them. I mean, he had spent so much time in prison. So when you really look at everything that he said and did, it was all about prison. Like, prison is segregated. That's kind of where his racial beliefs came from. Everything about him, all he talked about was like about survival, about life and death, about control, about giving up your sense of control. You know, even he was a very hard, people don't know this about Charles Manson, but speaking of whether or not he was evil, he was a very passionate environmentalist.
How bizarre.
Yeah, how strange, right? That he could, on one hand, be very, black and white in his thinking of life and death and murder, and on the other hand, up until his death, the last few times I spoke with him, he always talked about the environment. He was a very passionate environmentalist. But that was from prison, too, because what would happen is he would go to prison, and then, he'd camp or be in a field or a creek or a stream, and then he would go to prison for a number of years. And when he'd get out of prison, he'd go back to the creek, but it'd be gone. It'd be a shopping mall or, a restaurant or something.
Right.
And so he got these very impassioned views on the environment. And so everything about him is about prison. That's how he viewed the world. That's why, money wasn't a big deal for him. It was all about your word and your word being your bond and what you say, because when you break your word in prison, you can be killed.
Right.
And so when he was on the outside and someone broke their word to him, that was the justification for killing someone, and so everything about him was prison. So I don't really think necessarily he was, genetically evil or
right.
something like that. But, I think it's really clear where his views about morality and life come from, and it was from being in prison since the time he was nine.
Well, exactly. I think I wrote it down. By 24, by the age of 24, he'd been arrested 30 times.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about a commentary on relationships and the whole idea of loneliness and being solitary and not interacting with human, the culture around you and all that. And what is that? like what kind of an impact does that actually have? So
yeah,
you've got to bring up questions about reconciliation and rehabilitation and all that.
Yeah, I mean, and that's where he got music from with prison. That's where he got you know, his ability to manipulate people. That all came from prison. Everything.
Well, it's beautiful. Doesn't he say, "Prison is a mind"? Isn't that a direct quote?
Yeah. He'd always say that. He had this whole philosophy he made up. This is not in the documentary, but he had this philosophy he made up called the mind me. He would say this to me all the time, where he would say he viewed the world as if there's nobody but you, just you.
Right.
So
comes out a little bit in some of the conversations.
Yeah. He actually says it in context once. He says, me is all there is.
And that's right. Yeah.
And he'd say that to me. He's like, that's the mind me. Me is all there is. There's nobody but you. There's just you. And just like there's just Charlie. There's just you.
There's just Charlie, just, yeah. Is there anything you left out that you just couldn't put in, or you thought, you know what, there's another film here?
I'm
kind of fascinated by what didn't make it into the doc.
I think our first cut of the movie was over 3 hours. And I think it ended up being the version that's going to be available on iTunes on Monday, on the 30th in Canada, is an hour 45. There was a lot. Everything from, you know, we wanted to talk a lot more about what his life was like in prison. And he actually, after he went to prison, he started a new movement, a new group of, you know, a de facto Manson family that are called AWWA. Air, trees, waters, animals that are still around to this day. So we want to talk about that. We want to talk about his life in prison. We want to talk, there's more connections with Tex Watson and the Sharon Tate murders, and we want to talk about those. We just had to make choices.
Yeah, of course. That's got to be, that's the job of any storyteller, I suppose.
Yeah.
What do you know about, I just read too, I guess just before Christmas, isn't Tarantino going to be making a film now about Manson? Is that right? Have you
heard? Yeah, I know. I have heard it. Yeah, I know very little of it. Just what I've read in the Hollywood Reporter. But that is my understanding.
Won't it be fascinating too to see, you know, fact versus fiction and where, you know, Tarantino draws those lines
I'm a big fan of Quentin Tarantino, like everyone else. My understanding is that it'll be more Inglourious Basterds was about World War II, but it definitely was not any sort of, it was a fictional story told in the backdrop of World War II.
Sure.
And I think that's what this is too. So I don't know that it will really have a lot of, there will really be a lot to debate in terms of, it's standing in reality. I think it's more of a fictional story. But I know at least a few of the living Manson family members reached out to me to ask me if I knew anything about it and wondering how they would be portrayed. I think they're curious.
I bet. Well, it'll be interesting to see if they actually reach out to you as well for any kind of, context or fodder for writing. I mean, holy cow.
I doubt it, but I'm more than open to it.
Yeah, you never know, eh? What do you know? So you've been dabbling in crime, criminals, and psychopaths now for a few years. What do you learn about society? What do you learn about yourself?
One thing I've really learned about. Sorry to cut you off.
Yeah, no, go.
I'm very fascinated with psychopaths, the idea of psychopathology and sociopaths. And I think the idea of psychopaths is really misunderstood, and I'm really fascinated with that. I've spent time with psychopaths and talking to them on the phone and meeting them and things of that nature. And one thing I really think is misunderstood is that these are not sharks. They're not cold-blooded killers. Some of them are. But they're not emotionless robots who just can murder at random. I mean, I think Charles Manson and many of the other psychopaths I have met, can feel a wide range of emotions. They may feel them a lot differently and at different times and at different levels, and thus be capable of some pretty horrible things. But, you know, I think that it, like you said, I think earlier, that it's, people have a tendency to want to just paint things with a one color and kind of care. You know, it's very easy to understand someone as a monster. It's very difficult to understand someone as a very complicated
Absolutely.
Person.
Yeah.
Who makes complex decisions and has ugly, you know, that's one thing is a psychopath said this to me recently, but he's like, the truth is really ugly. And I thought that was a really, really apt way of putting it because all, you know, even the worst serial killers and killers and all this have these very complicated stories that are full of nuance and it takes a long time to understand them. And people don't often want to understand them.
No.
They just want to hear the cold notes. And
well, you,
that's
when
you get kind of these characters.
Yeah, and don't we to some degree want to label them, I suppose, madmans, madmen or madwomen, because it's easier. It is easier, and we can compartmentalize it. It makes it a little more black and white. We don't have to delve into, relational and family and mental health issues that would just reveal more layers, right? More depth.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not about creating excuses for it, but there's a difference between understanding what happened to a given individual and what happened in a crime, and then just kind of drawing a cartoon character of the crime.
Right.
And I think with Manson, he became, especially towards the end of his life, he very much became just a caricature of a person.
Right.
You know,
right. Sure.
You know, he was a cartoon villain by the end. And that's what I found really interesting is well, I wanted to understand really where he came from and really why he did the things he did and what led to all this.
I'm going to have to wrap it up here in a couple minutes, sadly.
Sure.
I'm just having a blast with this conversation. We barely touched on the Beach Boys and how that plays into that, because that was that was something I totally didn't understand, because when you kind of look back and you try to make some of those causal connections, and I know very little about the whole thing, it almost seems like the whole story of this, the madness of these killings and so on, comes out of this almost ludicrous story of revenge.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it. I mean,
yeah.
I can give you the Reader's Digest.
Go. Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, basically, you know, Dennis Wilson had this big mansion, and two of the Manson girls, Elijah Bailey, and I think it was Leslie Van Houten, it was Elijah Bailey and Patricia Krenwinkel, were hitchhiking, and he just picked them up one day. And took him back to his house, and you know, this was a different time, and then they ended up having sex, I believe, and then he went out, and then he came back, the rest of the so-called Manson family was there. And so they just crashed in his house for like a month.
For a month.
it was that simple. And they would play music and stuff, and Manson and Dennis Wilson kind of bonded. And, you know, the biggest evidence for me that they bonded was that Manson actually contributed a song to one of their albums. But what people don't understand, what we kind of reveal in the documentary and what many of the family kind of corroborated for me, was that Manson felt that he was going to be compensated for the use of that song. And he didn't do contracts or anything like that. It was all handshake deals. It was like I was saying earlier, it's all about your word.
Right. Sure. Yep.
So he felt that the record producer, Terry Melcher, had given his word that he would pay him $5,000 for the song. But he never received the $5,000. And that was really the beginning of the grudge that he had against him. And so when a whole other set of factors happened, and Manson and the group were looking for a spot to commit a crime, he thought, well, great, Terry Melcher's house, this will solve two birds with one stone, because he burned me on that song earlier. So that's going to be the spot. You know, and I think there's no question that none of the people that were involved in the Sharon Tate murders knew that Sharon Tate lived at that house.
Right.
I mean, at the trial, they tried to create this scenario in which Manson had met Sharon Tate at one point. And it's a long story, but that's a very suspect story, and that the witness actually recanted years later. But in my mind, I don't think any of them knew that Sharon Tate lived there. I think they all thought Terry Melcher lived there. And so, ironically, the fact that Sharon Tate did live there and she was a movie star really elevated what their crime and kind of, you know, made them famous, essentially. But I don't think that was their goal, was to murder a movie star. But they did, tragically, which made their crime really famous.
It's interesting, too, and I have to ask you this question now, just because of the compassion and the empathy question about Manson, because I can't help but not think about the mental health-like nature of some of this stuff, and I'm not, you know, I don't know, we haven't got time to get into all of that, but was it Susan Atkins who was there when Sharon Tate was murdered?
Susan Atkins is the one, that held her.
She was holding onto her, and she said something to the effect of, in her trial, and I think it's in the film, I had no compassion for her. I felt nothing for her, and then said something to the effect of, "Listen, bitch, you're going to die tonight," or something. And
She said, "Listen, bitch, you're going to die tonight, and there's not a thing you can do, I don't feel a thing behind it."
And that's just, I mean, I can't even, I mean, it's probably not a place to end the interview, but it really does raise some pretty interesting questions, and I hope drives people to see the film. By the way, produced by Pyramid Productions. Check them out online. That's pyramidproductions.com, isn't it? Or is it
.tv.
.tv, thanks.
Yeah,
so what can you say about that? That what gets a 20-year-old, 19, 20-year-old to a place that where she could actually say something like that and then commit that kind of crime? That is the question for me.
Yeah, I mean, a big part of it is LSD and...
Right.
And amphetamines, which is what she was on that night.
Right.
So they, you know, she had been taking... I mean, she said they took in those. One thing about Manson is you'll forget it. It took place over a very short period of time.
Right.
He was only out of prison for, I think it was under 2 years before this happened.
Right.
And the whole family was only together for maybe 18 months or something. So, but in that period of time, she said she dropped acid, she estimated 300 to 500 times.
Wow. Yeah.
So, I mean, that is a lot of acid.
Yes.
You know, So, I mean, her grip on, in terms of what does it take to get a person there, I mean, that alone is pretty much answers the question. They'd also taken amphetamines the night they went out on that. I mean, so she was just gone.
She was gone, yeah.
On top of that, I mean, Susan Atkins had a terrible childhood.
Yeah, which you bring out in the film.
Yeah, and that was another thing is, you know, because your question is, you know, how do you get there? You know, there's this myth that Charles Manson went around Southern California recruiting librarians and wannabe nuns that made them serial killers.
Sunday school teachers, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All the people that really, like Susan Atkins, Leslie Van Houten, Peter Krenwinkel, they all had just horrible backstories. Mm-hmm. Tragic things happened to them. And by the time they met up with Manson, they were really all very kind of lost souls.
Right.
Broken people, text too. So Susan Atkins in particular, I mean, she, her mother died of cancer. She was sexually abused, allegedly. She'd pretty much been abandoned by her family.
Mm.
And I actually got a hold of one of her family members and spoke to him. He was the person I got a hold of was going to be interviewed for our documentary, and he just it was just too hard for him. You know, it still affects their family.
Yeah, I bet.
And so we ended up not doing it. But Susan Atkins just had this, you know, horrible, and then she got into acid and drugs and kind of lived this life just trying to be devoid of feeling and consequence
right.
of dealing with anything, and it just spiraled. So by the time she got to Sharon Tate, I mean, that was the end of a long road.
Right.
And I think that's what we were saying earlier, is that when you look at all these events in crime, you know, the crime is always at the end of a long continuum of events. And sometimes it's very hard to step back and see how they all connect.
Yeah.
And people don't like to. They just kind of want to. If you just label that person as evil, then you understand it. You feel like you understand it.
Well, I think, you know, a fascinating film, and what a great conversation. So, I mean, we're talking about power and truth and justice and compassion and empathy. I mean, it's just, forget about Manson. There's way more important things to talk about. Listen, I really appreciate your time. We've been speaking with James Day today about his new film, Charles Manson, The Final Words, which is now available for everyone to see very mm-hmm. soon on iTunes. James, thanks. Thanks so much for your time today. I really do appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.